Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Ben Clymer Presents. We are presenting the Patek Philippe episode with none other than my good friend and one-time Houdinki contributor, John Reardon. How you doing, John?
Great. It's such a pleasure. Yeah, Houdinki, Ben, and so great to see you. And you too. I look forward to catching up on the record with you.
Yeah, we're doing this all on the record, so we're going to ask some tough questions. JK, not that tough. We had such great, frankly, success with the episode that we did with our friend Jeff Hess over at Sotheby's with the vintage Rolex episode. We thought, let's talk about the other great anchor of the watch collecting community. Nobody better to talk about Patek with than John. So I would say 10-second CV. You worked at Patek for a little while. You've worked at some great retailers, some great auction houses. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your history?
Sure. So I was lucky enough to grow up next to a watch and clock museum in my hometown, Bristol, Connecticut. And that eventually led me into the auction world. And then I had the dream call to work for Patek Philippe for a decade and went back to auction because I missed vintage so much. 4 years ago, I founded Collectability, which is focused only on buying and selling and educating on all things Patek Philippe. Yep. And that is it.
And you host a podcast over there. And who was your first guest again?
Wow. The first, you were the third guest.
Oh, I thought it was
that
the first.
We had. Well, no, you are the third guest. And since then, we're up to our 32nd episode. Our most recent guest was no other than Willie Andrews.
Wow. So I wanted to kind of, you know, start a little bit about the history of Patek Philippe at auction. You were an auction guy. You know it very well. And certainly a Patek guy. Would you say it's fair to say that Patek was the first brand to really support watches at auction? And if so, how did that really begin?
Oh, that's a great question. It was really 1989 is where that story starts. And not only did they support Patek Philippe at auction, they were part of the sale. And this Antiquorum sale, Habsburg Feldman from 1989, Patek Philippe, I understand now, was one of the consigners. They supplied information, they supplied marketing, and worked very closely with Osvaldo Patrizzi. I had the opportunity to do a podcast shortly after yours with Mr. Patrizzi, and he was sharing the stories of what that was like in 1989, working specifically with Philippe Stern and putting this sale together. So that was like when things really kicked off, and it was really a lot of attention was given to auctions. And in the 1990s, we could say the rest is history. It right. just, Patek Philippe became the king of auctions. Yes, the brand was buying watches at auction, and famously now, I guess it was like 22 years ago, I believe, there was a New York Times article.
Wall Street Journal, I think.
It was Wall Street Journal. Yeah. You're absolutely correct. Yeah. When was that? It was like 2000, 2001.
Something like that, yeah.
And it said the brand is buying watches back from auction.
Which now everybody does, to be
which,
fair.
Yeah, it's right. kind of the norm. But interestingly, at that point in time, particularly backed off considerably and stopped buying watches at auction, but their own watches.
Because of that journal story.
I think that article made them reconsider the policy. And the museum has had, at that point, such an amazing collection that they stopped actively buying and pursuing pieces at auction. What's funny is they continued to buy pieces from Breguet. Some of the most important Breguet pieces that are in the museum today were bought by Patek Philippe. So they were supporting the auction industry, they're supporting the some of these incredible other brands, but not necessarily their own brand.
But I think, you know, there's a few tropes that exist within the Houdinki comment community, mm-hmm. right? There's like, oh, you know, the idea that if a brand is buying a watch back, it's because they want to prop up pricing. And as far as I know, most businesses, of which all watch companies are, like to spend more money than they have to on things. I mean, it's just like completely ridiculous logic. And then the idea that like somebody who made something wouldn't want to buy something back. And I can tell you that there was one of our Leica cameras at a charity auction very recently in Germany. In fact, this past weekend, I bid on it very seriously because it was a prototype Houdinki mm-hmm. Ghost. Why wouldn't I want that? Right. And so you get this idea that in the comments section here and elsewhere that brands are running this like subversive plan to prop up pricing and spend more money than they have to, which in many cases is just not reality. It's because they want to own the thing.
I think your listeners and the market in general is too smart to fall for that. Maybe in the past, there were examples of course, brands propping up prices, but I think there's a lot more transparency now. And I think of the last two decades, that's not part of the narrative.
Right.
Sometimes part of the attack narrative, but not part of
the actual
the reality.
Right.
And when you go to the auction rooms, you can see Rolex if they're bidding. You know what they're bidding on. You can see their strategy, how they're doing it, and whether or not they win.
Right.
And as a former auction guy, we were in the room, we were watching what the brands were doing, and I think it's much cleaner than what people think. The brands are transparent. They don't want headaches. Yet, if they see a watch they want to buy, they're going to buy it. It's just to the highest bidder it goes.
Absolutely. And I think that is one of the great misconceptions about auction in general. People think there's a lot more funny business going on than there is in most cases. But taking a step back to that anniversary auction, the 150th yes. of Patek anniversary, run us through some of the highlights of that sale.
Oh, well, going back in time, geez. I mean, there were 24.99s every example,
including platinum,
including the platinum, right. 24.99.
Right. And where did that watch come from?
That was personally Philippe Stern's collection. Right. This is mythology again.
Right. Yeah.
At that point, people said he had a drawer.
Right.
I'd love to see this drawer.
Sure. Yeah.
Of all of these unsold pieces from Patek Philippe's heritage, and there were two 24.99s in platinum, and that was the one that stayed with the Stern family, and he. And I don't know the mechanics if he consigned or the company consigned, but he contributed that watch to the sale in some way.
Right.
I don't remember what it brought in that auction back in '89, but it was people understood that was an important piece that had an amazing past and certainly has an amazing future.
Yeah, and that watch was manufactured when the platinum.
Oh, wow. That fourth series, so early 80s.
Early 80s, right? So it wasn't a vintage watch. I mean, I think we tend to think of 2499s as old vintage watches, but, you know, it was probably made 5-7 years before the sale.
You know, I never thought of it that way. Yeah. I mean, it was a five-year-old watch at that time.
Right. It was a used watch.
Yeah. Exactly.
Exactly. And the Platinum 2499, quite famously, I would say, appeared at auction after it was in the collection of Eric Clapton via Orel at Christie's. The man behind the camera shot a great video about it. I think there's some rotating doors in that video that people still talk about walking into Christie's. It was pretty, exactly. but a watch that really resonated with me because it was one of the first videos we did around auction. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I really got to know Orel Box, who, you know, is now an icon of the space. And that watch in particular hasn't appeared since for sale anyway. So that watch sold, whatever, in 2012 or 13 for 3 point something. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it was in the threes.
Right. And so, and that's the only privately owned platinum 2499. The other one's in the museum. Where do you think that watch would be today?
It's funny. I was just going to ask you that same question. That's what we're finding in our space is the pieces that are unique, well, in this case, one of two, they just keep going up as other things are going down. I think that's easily a $10 million watch plus.
So the guy who bought it however many years ago did okay.
I don't think he'd be disappointed if it came back in the market.
I think, jumping around a little bit, but like how, if that watch has, say, we're going to say conservatively 4X, 5X, whatever you want to call it, minimum 4X, 3X. If that watch has gone up so much in the past, say, 10 years, what watches have gone down in the past 10 years with the increase in interest in watches, as we said, many fold? You were saying that you pitched a book on watches many years ago to a well-known publisher, and he basically said to fuck off effectively.
That's basically it.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that probably wasn't that long ago, and now watches are on the tips of everybody's tongue.
That's true. I mean, the last 15 years, 15 to 20 years, we'll say, watch culture has changed considerably. Yeah. And a real extreme example of that is this. When I joined Sotheby's in 1997, I didn't work for Sotheby's watch department. I joined Darren Schnipper, in Sotheby's watch and clock department.
Right.
And at that point in time, we basically covered all things horological. And a good part of my day was dealing with not only some American clocks, English clocks, even Japanese lantern clocks. I mean, we had to know, study, catalog, and sell those, as well as Daytonas, as well as pocket watches, as well as early enamels. It was even sundials were included in that mix. And that's a big difference of where I look at auctions today, which maybe 60 or 70% could be modern watches,
absolutely,
which is a cut and paste job and market pricing.
Yeah.
So the world has changed a lot in the last 20, 25 years, and in particular in the auction world.
Mm-hmm. So to kind of go down another layer here, like, again, if the 2499P is worth 3 to 4X, what wristwatches, and let's get nerdy here, give me some references, are worth less now than they were then? Are there any?
Yeah, if we think, well, I'm talking outside of my space of knowledge, but I'm going back, digging up some Rolex knowledge.
Sure.
Rolex Princes right. were unbelievably hot in the 1990s, early 90s in particular. Rolex Bubblebacks
sure. famously.
I mean, were famously white hot. In terms of Patek Philippe, 990 caliber, some of these amazing rectangular watches, yeah. The Banana, the Marilyn Monroe, all of those brought really important numbers back in the 90s.
And so just quickly, what is an important number for something like that?
Oh, back, okay, let's take like a top hat, $1,450, which today you can buy for sometimes like $6,000-$8,000, which right. is so well worth it. Yeah. Back then, relative, it would bring $12,000 to $15,000. So that's incredible if we're going back in time, yeah. 25 years. So what trends have changed over time and what people are looking at and what people are collecting is a constantly evolving mm-hmm. force. And it's fun to imagine what it will be like in another 10 years. And certainly there are uncovered opportunities today that we're just not paying attention to.
And I definitely want to talk about that kind of later in the show, but let's flip the script a little bit and say if the top hat is, say, worth, I'm going to estimate 50% of what it was 10, 15 years ago, what is now worth 2 to 3, 4, 5x?
Wow, almost everything else, it seems. Yeah. Calatravas, just like take like 96s, 570s. Maybe those have gone up 2 to 3x, like relative to, if we have to factor in how just inflation sure. which is a major factor. I hope we could talk about inflation course, yeah. later, because that's interesting. But of course, the Nautilus storyline is just extraordinary.
I actually totally forgot about Nautilus, which is weird. Let's talk about this. Okay. 3700, the original Nautilus. Mm-hmm. I bought my first one from Matt Bain. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a cert. It had an extract, but it came with the famous cork box, and I paid $18,000 for it.
Amazing.
Sold it for probably...
How long ago is that?
10 years. Probably, okay. Something like that. I probably sold it for $18,001, something like that. Yes. You know, and I thought it was the smartest guy in the room. So if that watch was, say, $18,000, $20,000 10 plus years ago, where's a good 3700 today?
You know, at its height, which would be about a year ago, year and a half ago, easily 200,000 plus for a prime example with all the bells and whistles.
Right. You
know, the box, the original certificate, have an archive to back it up.
Yeah.
In condition, of course. Today, those have dropped. It's kind of solidly in the 150 to 175 range.
For a good set.
For a full set.
Yeah.
But to buy one just like to wear archive only could be like $125 today. So they have dropped considerably.
But I mean, as a guy who's seen it sell for $18,000-$20,000 as a consumer, can you wrap your head around that? I mean, obviously, as somebody who sells them, of course you can. But as somebody who's buying them as a lover of them, how do you justify that?
It's tough. I mean, these are wearable works of art. I mean, it's like, sure. you know, our whole propaganda that we share.
Yes.
But when you, I'd almost want to pivot the answer to that to 5711s. And the reason I want to answer that question around 5711s is there's less of the condition variable. With the 3700, that's mint. If one's like untouched, full set, like truly untouched, not detailed, I could see it bringing 200,000 today.
For a 5711?
So, no, I'm talking 3700. For a 3700. Yeah. So it's kind of unfair to compare 3700s because the data doesn't factor in condition. Mm-hmm. 5711s we can, because there's just hundreds, if not thousands, of comps. And we've seen the rise of 5711 prices skyrocket. I mean, it was extraordinary to see how fast 5711 prices have gone down. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we have to keep an eye on and understand that these aren't commodities for investment. These are watches at the end of the day. And well, people that tried to game the market pretty much lost.
Yes, unless they sold that you know, for that 6 month period. Yeah. So the retail on a 5711 was what, 28, something like that?
The last was like 42, but yeah, like 28,000. Then retail broke 40 for a short amount of time before being discontinued.
And at its peak, where was a steel non-Tiffany full set 5711?
Non-Tiffany, you're like 150 right. easily.
And then where was the Tiffany sign steel?
There's something that would trade at 350 with Tiffany blue dial.
Yeah.
Not the Tiffany blue dial. That's another story.
That's all other. and so, you know, again, Jeff Hess and I talked about it with the vintage Rolex world. Like, how do you feel about the that incredible spike and then incredible valley of of, say, a 5711, because as you said, like, I can pull up my phone right now and find 25 mm-hmm. for sale at a reasonable price that actually exists. How do you feel about that? And then where is the price today versus its peak and its lowest point?
Today, the price is 100 is basically
which
the
is
number.
Still, right, let's say minimum 2.5 times retail, which it's back true. In the day was unheard of.
Which I wonder, does it have room to go down? I mean, I have a personal opinion on that.
Let's hear it.
I don't think it's going to go up for a while.
You think it's going to go down more?
There's just too much inventory out there, and I think we're going to see a return to prices maybe from 2 to 3 years ago. And I'm trying to do that just with all of my pricing and just looking at numbers is where were things 2 to 3 years ago before the COVID bump?
Right.
And I think we're trying to do that in a lot of different spaces. And I find it really interesting to see the outliers of things that are going up that aren't following that trend. And in some pieces, it's actually going down even a bit further than where they were 2 to 3 years ago.
So I want to talk about that, but let's continue with 5711. So the standard steel watch now, you said, is about $100,000.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, mint full set.
Yeah,
that's mint the number. Full set.
And are those, if you can, when was the last time you sold one of those, and how easy was it to sell?
Wow. It's not my wheelhouse with collectability. Nautilus, especially modern Nautilus, is not what I do.
Yeah.
But of course, I took some pieces for trade in. Yeah, I was able to get solid 130, 135 at its height, mm-hmm. and I'd usually sell those to other dealers because it's not something that I'd want to market on our platform.
Right. So let's play kind of a numbers and name game here a little bit. So I would say the modern icon of watch collecting, a watch that has appeared on Talking Watches, probably more than any other, would be mm-hmm. a 5970.
Yes.
Tell me where the 5970 market is now and what you think about it.
It's solid. Off the top of my head, let's say there's 3,500 to 4,000 examples.
Across metals.
Of cross metal, all four metals.
And can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you know that or are you assuming that?
That's, let's say it's not assuming, but based on a back-to-market coefficient, we'll call it. And best educated guess.
Understood.
Patek Philippe has not shared that right. publicly. Because a big question, like which is the rarest metal? The yellow gold or
it's
the J. platinum?
It's got to be J, right?
I think it's J.
Yeah.
Just based on what we've seen come back.
Yeah.
Everyone assumes it's platinum. Yeah. But they haven't shared the numbers yet.
Right.
And I hope they do someday. So the state of the 5970, it is, and you've very popularly shared on Hodinkee, is one of the most perfectly designed Patek Philippe modern watches.
Agreed.
I personally agree. I absolutely love having one on my wrist. And other people that are new to the world of Patek Philippe that might not have had one in the past, they put that watch and then they become a believer and they absolutely love it. Mm-hmm. Where's the future of that from a price perspective?
I think where's today, first of all?
Sure. So platinum, if you're in low 300s, I think that's retail mm-hmm. Number today. Yellow, it's easily above 200 now. We're talking mint complete set.
Sure.
Yellow in some cases is bringing more than rose and white, which I'd put in that like 175 range. Mm-hmm. They're not as easy to find as they were a few years ago. They're increasingly more difficult to find, and people are willing to pay for condition in a way. And with the 5970 in particular, if it's polished, you could tell from a mile
quickly,
away.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the way the shape of the lugs and the crispness. So there's, if you have a mint one, try to keep it mint, but wear it and enjoy it. It's not going to go down in value. Mm-hmm. Sadly, we see this all the time. So many examples have the missing case back or the missing cert. It's increasingly difficult to sell a 5970 or almost any modern Patek that's not fully complete. Mm-hmm. So need to check all the boxes and have everything in order to pay that kind of retail money for an example. But I think over time, it's a safe bet.
So you think those still have legs, even though the average young guy or gal today might not even, I mean, removing the Hodinkee mm-hmm. audience, right, and the collectability, you know, audience. You think young guys know what a 5970 is versus a 5167, 5711?
I think a lot of the, like, thinking outside of the watch community,
right.
like all of us that are like following these things on a day-to-day basis, I think a 5970 or more broadly a perpetual chrono from Patek Philippe is a dream watch for a lot of people that are going down that direction. It's funny because as soon as they find out it's not automatic, you could sometimes lose people.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, I have to wind
it. That's the worst. Yeah.
So yeah, they're like, oh, nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
But others, they put it on their wrist. I'm just thinking of a client I showed one to recently, and they're like, I like the size, I like the aesthetic, and compared to XYZ brand that they wore in the past, this is an easy transition to one of the modern icons of collecting.
Yeah. So, I mean, John and I have basically called it like the Daytona of the paddock world. Like it's like it's sporty, it's masculine, it's easy to understand, relatively speaking, and it's just kind of a perfect thing.
And I think we're going to continue talking about the 5970 and the same legacy as 2499s and 1518s.
So you're skipping over the 3970 in that lineage.
Because I want to talk about the 3970 in more detail.
Let's do it.
After. So I find that the 5970, though, is kind of it's that watch that's very quickly becoming vintage, almost officially vintage. Yeah. And more and more people are discovering it. So let's see what happens in the future.
So then 3970, obviously immediate predecessor, much smaller. In my opinion, really wears like a vintage watch. It's smaller than a 2499. You know, the round pushers and all the stuff that really feel very Patek Perpetual Chrono. Certainly an increased interest in it, but nowhere near 5970 level.
Yeah, and interestingly, like 3970 numbers, once again, based on what we expect, around 4,000 examples made.
Is that so? I thought there were many more than...
This is my estimation, over 18 years. So that's a long spread for the 3970. Now, the first series of the snapbacks, they're through the roof right now. And almost everything I'm saying, same thing is true with 3940s. Right. So like first series are just through the roof. But the condition is everything. But I've seen second series prices get very strong with 3970. I'm talking yellow gold, the most common example. And then the late series are still a bargain. I mean, to wear a perpetual chrono and pay around 100 and change.
For a J.
For yellow gold, is still a very attractive value proposition. So they're out there. It's a piece that's available. The question that I have, and this is where the 5970 and 3970 values may lie in the future, is what about the size? And there's a very real trend towards smaller watches. So I'm seeing more people, men and women, wearing 3970s than ever before. 5970s are a big watch where for people who like larger watches, it's always there for them. Mm-hmm. But I don't know where the future I mean, in theory, 3970 should be higher price point than 5970s, but they're not.
But why? So, why do you say that? Why should they be higher?
I think it's earlier. There's more time has passed. More case backs have been lost. More polishing has been done. So supply and demand, the best examples should be bringing a super premium. But 5970s, I think, are in a magic space. Mm-hmm. It's like a fan club around 5970s that just keeps getting bigger.
So let's talk 5270.
Yes.
What do you think?
Historically, we're going to look back at this as a really good time to buy 5270s. Everyone's turning their back on the 5270 right now.
I think they'd be, I own one. I think they're amazing.
You love it?
I love it. I got married in that watch.
So that's your keeper.
It's a keeper.
So aesthetically, though, how do you find... Do you prefer the 5270 over a 5970?
I currently don't own a 5970, although I have in the past. Mm-hmm. The 5970 is probably more balanced. I think as somebody who cares not only about how it wears and aesthetics, the 5270 is a better movement, not even close. It's also finished better, in my not-so-humble opinion. That matters to me as a watch guy who spent a lot of time around watchmakers. And then I think ultimately everything with me is the story, and not only that I was married in one, but like... the 5970 was before my time. I could never ever have afforded one when those were in retail, ever. Like, not even close. Even in the late stages when you had the P's and all that, like, just never. You know, it was, like, so beyond my comprehension. But the in particular, Platinum, Perpetual Calendar Chronograph, from Patek Philippe, all the P's, like, that was it. You know, it's like, that was the thing that I was working towards. And when I was able to buy one at retail, that was a really meaningful thing to me. And that was like, okay, like, I made it now, you know? And so that watch for that reason is incredibly special to me. I also happen to think that it's a beautiful watch. And I think, you know, as John said in our Talking Watches with Ed Sheeran, the first one was quite bad. You know, I really thought, like, aesthetically, like, there was some really odd design choices there in terms of the chin and, you know, how they used the font. By the time it resolved itself into where we are now, which is the rose gold and the pea and the salmon and the green, I think it's a beautiful watch. And like, you know, it's not like we've come around on that. Patek actually changed the dial to make it that much more appealing. And I think those are just lovely watches
now. Which version do you have?
I have platinum salmon dial.
Platinum salmon. The salmon's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting thing in collecting and in trends. And I realize I'm not like the youngest person anymore in the room, which it felt like my whole first part of my career obviously was.
Sure. I feel the same way.
You know the thing. Yeah. You know the feeling. It's fascinating.
It's nice when people call me a blogger and I'm like, I'm 41, dude. You know, like, give me a break. Yeah. Only happens in Switzerland.
Only in Switzerland. Yeah. It's so important to remember that like trends and tastes will change, and the definition of vintage is constantly changing.
Yeah.
And what you just said, how the 5270, if it's kind of connects with you emotionally,
yeah,
you're not the only one.
Right.
So, and I do think in the same way, sometimes pieces from the past, which were hero pieces that like have just completely been forgotten, of pieces that are just obsessions for people in the past. For example, 3448s and 3450s.
Yeah.
That was like the trophy for so many people who grew up and might have saw them on a father or a grandfather.
Yep.
And I think people are there is a circle of people who appreciate that for what it was, but there's a dislocation in value.
So it's funny,
pieces in particular.
Funny you mentioned that. I was actually offered a 3448 full set J recently. That's a watch I've never owned and always wanted. Where do you think those are these days?
Oh, a night full set, you said? Oh, mint.
Okay. What does that even mean, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Everything's been polished.
Right.
Like 175 is kind of the number that I put on that.
And what about a white gold?
Oh.
It's a different thing.
Okay, 60,000 to 100,000 if it's really minty.
Right.
You take a 3448 in white gold, that watch, especially when the earlier series,
perfect
it
watch.
Just melts your heart.
Yep. It's a perfect watch.
And they bring important money for a good reason.
In white gold.
In white gold.
In yellow, you know, Phillips famously had that really, really mint watch probably 4 years ago that sold for, I think, 500,000, like a big number, right? But historically, they don't bring anywhere close to that.
No, there's some on like in the vintage world that are circulating that are well above that price point in white gold.
In white gold, right.
In white gold. Right. Oh, you're talking yellow gold ones.
Yes.
I remember at Christie's, we sold some yellow gold, like prime examples for, I remember, in the high threes.
Right.
It's kind of the biggest number.
Yeah.
But the fact that you could still pick one of those up for under 200 in yellow gold is interesting.
And it's automatic. And it feels modern.
Yes.
It really is. It's kind of, in my opinion, a perfect hybrid of old and new, just like I think the 3970 is, and 3940 for that matter. So we did perpetual calendar chronos. Let's talk about chronos.
Yes.
Well, let's start with 1463, 130s, all 533s, all those vintage chronographs. Where are they now? And I realize that there's very different things there in those references, but like, do people care about those anymore?
It's not like it was.
Right.
But I'm optimistic that will change. I think 33.5 millimeters
tough.
Is considered a little small.
That's tough.
On 130 or 533. But when you put one on the wrist, people tend to fall in love with it. And I love the fact that there is increasingly a wider female audience, which loves vintage Patek Philippe. And wearing a 130 or 533 or even a 1463, which is a bit bigger, it just looks incredible on any wrist. So I think there is a good future with those, but right now they represent a value buy, in my opinion.
Okay, so let's go to 1463, because I think that's the one that most guys are, that I've had a few, I love them. Where's a good 1463 J today?
You could pick one up for a good one under 100,000. I mean, which is crazy, because for a while they're easily approaching 200 for a good one. Mm-hmm. Great is another story.
Sure.
So it comes down to condition again.
And I've long said, probably on this platform somewhere, that like the vintage watch that I'll own and wear every day when all this is said and done would be a 1463 steel on a bracelet. Where are those today?
Well, I haven't had one personally, but just looking at prices at auction, they're in that 2 to 250 range for really prime example.
For steel.
And steel.
Okay, that's actually steel. Much less than I imagined.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's move towards the modern era. 5070. How are those today?
5070Ps are still very hot. Just sold one yesterday, and I'm regretting it already.
Can you share roughly the range on that?
Sure, in the high 100s, they're kind of that 175 to 185 range. Wow. Consistently,
which today is significantly more than any of the other metals.
Yes.
Why?
Strangely, you take like G or R, the white or the rose, and they are just, they're like stuck at that 75 to 80.
Which they were like range. 6 years ago, too.
Yeah, yeah, it's like completely stable. Yeah. Platinum has jumped. Interesting, like, so I'm looking for a couple of clients to find a really nice 5070J.
Right.
I actually think today, if a really mint one surfaced, I think I could get a historically higher number for it from a retail buyer.
Right.
They're tough to find. Yeah. And that that black dot, that old yellow school, gold,
yeah,
that's just like, that's where it all began.
Yeah.
I think we're going to start seeing those when we're not there yet, but we're going to start seeing those over 100,000 soon.
And then,
I hate forward-looking statements.
No, of course.
That's kind of the
nobody
trend.
Knows, but you know, yeah, that's what we're here to do. 5170P or 5170 in general. I mean, I'm wearing a P right now. I think they're great watches.
Such great watches. Yeah. Great values. So I actually haven't sold one, so I don't know the price point. But yellow gold ones seem to be offered all the time.
For nothing,
so,
right?
Yeah, really, really reasonable.
And these numbers are now discontinued. So we have a 5172. So you would think in theory these should pop at some point.
They should. They should. So
we have only a few minutes left, and we're going to do some rapid-fire stuff. But quickly, if favorite Patek Philippe ever made, if you had unlimited budget, didn't have to insure it, what vintage Patek would, or what Patek would you own? Can be in the museum as well.
It's a piece in the museum.
What is it?
That I didn't even know it existed, and I was over there recently and was enamored by it as an understatement. It's a Patek Philippe pocket watch,
okay,
which might be the first surprise.
Yeah.
It's a Patek Philippe ellipse pocket watch,
okay,
which might be the second surprise. And now it gets weird. It's a Patek Philippe musical ellipse pocket watch.
I don't even know what that means.
So only one was ever made in Patek Philippe's history. This is a skeletonized Patek Philippe ellipse pocket watch where you push a button, and it had Grand and Petite Sonnerie, and it actually plays music on the hour and quarter on demand.
And what song is it?
We haven't been able to identify the song yet, but you press the button on the crown, like it looks like almost like a chronograph button,
yep,
and you see this central disc that has a Calatrava on it engraved with these pins that come up. So it's like a disc type system, and it has 24 forks that are each jeweled, and it plays music as this thing spins around. I never knew this existed. We've all been to the Patek Philippe Museum,
sure,
a million times.
Yeah.
And this watch is, for me, the dream watch. It's a one-off. And the more that I learn about it, it was a pet project of Henry Stern for an important client.
What year are we talking about?
1976.
Okay.
So the fact that Patek Philippe just took these risks, even in the midst of the quartz revolution, is very interesting, right, to me.
Sorry, Henry Stern or Philippe Stern?
Pet this project is his father. So okay, this is Henry Stern.
Wow.
So this is going back another generation.
Yeah.
So right now, that's like my dream piece, but it's great. It's a very safe dream piece. It's only one. It's in the museum.
You're never going to be offered
I'm never going to get one.
Yeah.
And that's it. But that's the one that captures my imagination. Of course, there's about a dozen wristwatches,
sure,
I would do anything for.
Yeah.
But that's the one at the top of my mind.
Okay. So we're going to end this with a quick little rapid fire, and then we're going to let you go.
Sure.
5070J versus 1463J, which one do you buy?
Oh, for me, 5070J, just because of the price point.
Just because of the price. Let's remove price, just so we can get to the heart of the matter here.
Oh, if remove price, I'd want the 1463.
Okay.
Because for me, a 5070 is too big on the wrist.
Got it. Best $24.99 you've ever held.
Oh, that's a tough one. $24.99 first series Serpico.
So yes. Was that yellow gold or?
That was a yellow gold example that we had at Christie's, which is
just crazy.
Remember, it was a season where two Serpicos surfaced at the same time.
It always happens that way.
Yes, it was incredible. Yeah, that was the best one I've seen with my own eyes.
If you had the opportunity to buy the best 25-26 in the world or the best 34-28 in the world, which one would you buy?
We didn't talk about 25-26s. Yeah, if I could have a 25-26 and with a Tiffany dial, I think that would really capture
Phillips just sold one, as you may have known.
I wasn't bidding, but yeah. I'd love to have one.
Yeah, yeah, that's a neat one. 34-48 or 15-26?
34-48, even though 15-26.
Nice, it's nice. And to wrap it all up, if you had, or you out there had, and let's get incredibly crass here. You have $100,000 to spend right now, And the game is if you can convert that $100,000 into $200,000 within 5 years, you get $1 million. What would you buy?
This might get some of the listeners upset, but I'd buy a Patek Philippe complicated pocket watch.
Okay.
I really, really do believe that if you're playing from like a market perspective.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Because I think now that we're having more transparency than ever before in terms of condition from sellers, pocket watches are like the last segment of truly unmodified, untouched examples of horology that we have from the past. And I love the fact that you can find a piece from 100, 150 years ago and know what's actually been done with it.
Right, nobody does.
Relative certainty, because nobody's restoring the enamel dials in that same way. The cases, since they're a bit larger, you can actually see everything that's been done. You know it's been polished. You know it hasn't. Yep. And the argument against that is people aren't wearing pocket watches. Sure. Hey, trends can change.
That's right.
But even in the past 4 years, and my answer would have been same 4 years ago, pocket watches are one of the safest places.
So repeating, split second, like real complications.
Exactly, real complications. Even time onlys have done well.
Yeah.
So I really believe that there's a future there.
Okay.
But that's a total money play.
Okay.
Okay.
So we're going to come back with John Reardon in exactly 5 years.
Yeah, let's do it.
And see how he did on that prediction. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
I'll see you soon.
Thank you, Ben.